Cool, unflustered beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it's 10 p.m. Thursday. It is time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, Professor of Communication at the University of Houston Downtown, along with Jacob Reiner and our two new interns, Nicole and Alondra. On the boards, and for those of you who are boomers out there, it's sort of like Tony, Orlando, and Dawn. I don't know, right? Right, there you go. Writer and theologian Louis B. Smedy has declared that our sense of fairness requires that people pay for the wrongdoings. But for my guest storyteller, attorney and University of St. Thomas communication professor Nicole Cazares, a true sense of fairness demands that wrongdoers make things right, especially if the one doing the wrong is doing it in the name of justice. Fighting for fairness is what she does for the same reason she eats and sleeps, because she has to. Nicole teaches media law, wrongful convictions, and news writing. She's also visiting professor of law at the University of Houston Law Center. She received media attention in connection with the case of Texas death row inmate Anthony Graves, whose conviction was reversed by the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2006. Ultimately, Graves was exonerated in 2010, and it is this connection that fuels her stories tonight. Professor Kazarev also serves as the chair of the Houston Forensic Science Center, which governs the city of Houston's independent crime lab. She's a scholar in the First Amendment and criminal justice issues, and I'm in the position to know that she also plays the flute because my wife Peggy was her teacher. The other dilemma is that we have two Nicoles tonight, so I've decided that I'm going to call Nicole, our guest, Nicole, and you, Nicole, out there will be Nicole. How's that? All right. I'll have to remember that, but I think we'll be good to go. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
Finally. And I know that you've been here before.
I have.
And KPFT has been kind of good to you. And
very
as far
good.
As, yeah, and we're going to kind of get into that a little bit later. But let's get to the important stuff first. How's your flute playing going? That's really why you're
well,
here.
You know, not as good.
We have a flute for you to play.
Not as good today as it was when your wife Peggy was my teacher.
That's the right thing to say. She's sitting out right out there. God bless her. Nicole, the criminal issues aligned with the First Amendment are overwhelming. Religious impingement, the right to assemble, implications to freedom of speech are each inextricably related to the turbulence that really drives this political year. And I know it's difficult to choose a single criminal issue and the First Amendment, but let me be bold enough to ask, what impresses you as the most urgent criminal issue affecting the First Amendment?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question to answer, but I would say that I'm particularly interested in issues regarding government surveillance and the First Amendment. So here's an example. Police departments today all over the country use body cameras to record encounters with citizens. You know, the reason is to reduce violence and to have a record of what happened. Mm-hmm. But what about police using those cameras to record First Amendment activities, for example, protests or political gatherings? People may not be as willing to say certain things if they fear that they're being monitored by the government, and that can have a chilling effect on speech and expressive rights, especially for those who want to say things that are criticisms or could be perceived as dissent.
Right. When I teach a rhetoric class, I talk about the First Amendment and freedom of speech, and it's amazing how many people really don't know what that means. Exactly. And I'm glad that you're sharing that. And if we have time, I want to dabble in that a little bit later. I have a feeling that it'll be frustrating enough where I'm going to have you come back and talk about these a little bit more. But Anthony Graves was convicted of capital murder. The prosecutor was disbarred. You and your students got to the truth. Mr. Graves conveyed immense gratitude to you. You accepted no money and you devoted years of your life fighting for your life in many ways, but also for this incredibly courageous man, and to set him free. The students in your course were in what law course?
It was undergraduate class.
Undergraduate.
It was an investigative journalism class.
Magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know why I thought it was law students. I guess it just anticipated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were into it, obviously.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, and that obviously is part of your first story. And before telling us this tale of unfathomable grit and determination on the part of you and your students, if you'd be so kind as to remind us a little bit about the crime for which Anthony was convicted.
Yeah,
please.
Sure. So Anthony was convicted of a multiple murder that happened in 1992 in the small town of Somerville, Texas. And six family members were killed. It was really very gruesome. They were stabbed, bludgeoned. One was shot. Gasoline was poured over their bodies, and the house was set on fire. In this family, there were four little children under the age of 10. So Anthony and a co-defendant, Robert Carter, were both convicted and sentenced to death.
Mm. Tell us the story.
So let me start this way. Have you ever been blamed for something that you didn't do? Perhaps when you were a kid, your sibling did something and you took the blame. Or maybe when you were in school, a classmate broke a rule, but you suffered for it. Maybe your mom or dad or your school teacher didn't know or didn't really care who the real culprit was, and you experienced how hard it was to prove your innocence, to prove that you didn't do something. Well, that's how it is in families and at school. But our criminal justice system is supposed to be different. We don't make a criminal suspect prove his or her innocence. We're not supposed to. And we certainly wouldn't condemn a man to death if we weren't sure he was a killer, would we? So my story is about the investigation that my students and I conducted into the case of Anthony Graves, a man who was blamed for something that he didn't do. Anthony and another man, Robert Carter, as I said, were convicted of the six murders and sentenced to death. And Robert Carter had already been executed when my students and I started looking into Anthony's case. Anthony said he was innocent, that Robert Carter had implicated him in an attempt to save his own skin. Was Anthony guilty? Was he lying when he claimed to be wrongfully convicted? Or was it possible that he was telling the truth? How does one go about figuring that out? So we started by looking at the big picture, and then we filled in the details. We were looking for the answers to three questions. One, what evidence convicted Anthony? Number two, did that evidence hold up? Was it solid? Was it airtight? Or was it bogus, unreliable? And number three, was there evidence of innocence that the jury never heard? So answering those questions was like putting together an enormous jigsaw puzzle where you have to search for and find the pieces yourself. So to get a quick overview of the case, we read court opinions and media accounts. What did newspapers write about the case at the time? We were looking for names, details, information that maybe wasn't presented in court. Oh, and the newspapers we needed to read didn't have searchable online databases. This kind of investigation can't be conducted over the internet. We made multiple car trips to little towns where the newspaper archives are cardboard boxes crammed full of old papers that we examined one at a time. We contacted all of Anthony's former attorneys who had represented him over the years. What did they remember about the case? Would they, with Anthony's permission, allow us to access their files? We read trial transcripts and looked at every document filed in the case. We looked at every exhibit to take down names, dates, details. We made a timeline and a cast of characters. We mastered every detail about the case. But that's when the real fun started, finding and talking to people who knew or might know something about the case or might lead us to others who might know something about the case. And this is the tricky part. It's the part that takes real work and determination. First, you have to identify people to talk to. Then you have to find them. Then you have to convince them to talk to you. And if they tell you something useful, you have to convince them to give you a written statement and ultimately to come to court and testify. So I said we were searching for the answers to three questions, and this is what we learned over 8.5 years. Number one, what was the evidence against Anthony? What we learned was very little. Anthony was convicted primarily by the testimony of his co-defendant, Robert Carter, plus the testimony of a jail guard who said he overheard Anthony and Robert making incriminating statements. And finally, the testimony of a Texas Ranger who held himself out incorrectly to be a knife expert. Question number two, did the evidence hold up? What we learned, it did not. It was erroneous, it was perjured, it was fabricated, or it was junk science. Question number three, was there significant evidence of innocence that the jury did not hear? The answer, yes. I'll tell you more about that in my second story. Happily, Anthony's conviction was overturned, and in 2010, all of the charges were dropped against him on the basis of actual innocence. Special Prosecutor Kelly Siegler spent months reinvestigating the case, only to conclude that everything my students and I had learned was right. She told Texas Monthly that our investigation had been dead on, and that every aspect of the case against Anthony Graves fell apart when it was critically examined.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. Nicole, you know, KPFT plugged you into Anthony while he was in prison during one of our prison shows, and you told us that story a little while ago. Could you fill us in and tell us about that circumstance, please?
So in 2006, Anthony's conviction was reversed by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it was reversed very late in the day on a Friday. And I really wanted to tell Anthony. I wanted him to know. He was on death row, you know, thinking that he was facing an execution date. And you just can't pick up the phone and call a death row inmate, and I wouldn't be able to visit him until Monday. So I thought of the prison show. So I called KPFT, and I explained what had happened, and they were well aware of Anthony's case, and they very graciously said, call in at, I don't remember, 8 o'clock, I think, and we'll give you 2 minutes, and you can talk to him. You can talk to him over the radio, and Anthony had a radio, mm-hmm. and, you know, he actually wasn't listening at that particular moment, but another prisoner on death row was, and sent him a note. And so within 15 minutes of when I was on the air, he learned that he was being
beautiful story. Yeah.
You know, released.
Thank you. Yeah. That's amazing. It really is an amazing story. You're drinking champagne right in your office.
With all my students, we were all there.
It's also
there.
A great testament to KPFT. I mean, not a very profound thought, but you know, KPFT really is the institutional icon for community radio in the city.
It was the only place that I could have possibly have had that. Yeah. Had the ability to do that.
Yeah, unbelievable. What a beautiful, beautiful story. Thank you. This is Hank Rubicek with Jacob Reiner, and you are listening to guest storyteller, attorney, and University of St. Thomas communication professor Nicole Kazarev on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston. Nicole, I'm curious, how apologetic, how much remorse did the court express to Mr. Graves?
The Texas District Court mm-hmm. in Burleson County, absolutely none.
Absolutely none.
No remorse at all. Not even an apology. The special prosecutor who dismissed the charges on the grounds of actual innocence wanted to have a ceremony in the courthouse the next day to announce her findings, and the judge refused to do it.
And I was afraid that you were going to say that, and that's why I am interested in this concept of taking responsibility. But how difficult... was it for Mr. Graves to forgive, out of curiosity?
Oh.
He seems like a very forgiving man.
Absolutely. I mean, what he told me and what he's said to everyone, he spent enough time being angry about it and mm-hmm. enough time behind bars. And now that he's in the free world, he wants to live. He wants to enjoy life. He doesn't want to be mired in the past. So
18 years, right?
He was 18, yeah, years. 18 and a half years. Yeah, he has no time.
And a half years of
he has no time to be angry.
What an amazing man. And that really is an amazing man. That's the kind of hero that really does constitute a hero, a person who somehow can say, it was a tremendously terrible mistake. It really ruined my life for almost 2 decades. And somehow he's still able to forgive. And this is so important to me because I think that ownership, taking ownership, is really the hallmark of a fair society. And currently, the general inability for a society to take ownership seems to be part of this crazy world, an unfortunate trend set brilliantly by the king of I take no ownership, Donald Trump. Nicole, why is it so hard for some people to admit that they were wrong?
Well, you know, I can only tell you my opinion with respect to the prosecutor or the state with respect to Anthony's case. Mm. And the prosecutor really had tunnel vision. I mean, he made up his mind about Anthony in 1992 based on, and these are his words, his gut feeling. His gut feeling told him that Anthony was guilty and that he couldn't be wrong. He just couldn't be wrong. And he was important. He was powerful in that county. He had the power to ruin people's lives. So everyone just went along with him. And after Anthony was exonerated, law enforcement officers told me that they had some doubts about Anthony's guilt and that they actually thought that maybe he really was innocent. But at the time, they did nothing.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I struggle with delineating what is right from what is legal, and I think that many people do. It's a really tough question, but are there circumstances when you think that you might encourage your students to do what's right and not what's legal? I mean, you know, the Jim Crow law is an example, but is there a situation?
I can give you an example that I think really speaks to my journalism students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reporters can legally publish almost any accurate information that he or she gets legally. But it's not always right to publish everything. You know, just because you learn something, I tell my students all the time, just because the law says you can publish it doesn't mean that it's right to publish it. You have to ask yourself, personal information about someone might be interesting to some, but is it newsworthy? Is it relevant? Just because you can publish doesn't mean you should. Right.
There's that moral contemplation is that sense of ethos that you really have to ask yourself whether or not it's a good idea to do so.
I mean, if something's not in the public interest, and sometimes personal information can cause great harm.
Right. Yeah. You know, Jacob, where are you, my friend? You are a communication graduate. The other two ladies are getting there. They'll be there real soon. But you're a graduate, and you just heard what Nicole said about her own undergraduate communication majors. That has to, her students, that has to motivate you in a lot of ways. But I'm curious about your take on this. When do you follow what's right and not legal?
Being a veteran, it's kind of skewed, but with what you just said, morals, it really has, to me, it goes on the moral line. Like Nicole also said, just because you can do it doesn't mean you have to do it.
Right, and I appreciate that. Very, very good. But, you know, Nicole, on the boards, right? Nicole, there you are. Wake up, everybody. Okay. It's both wrong and against the law to not tell our listeners about our sponsor, the best darn storyteller group around, so would you please do that?
Whether you're seasoned or a greenhorn at storytelling, the Houston Storytellers Guild is the most supportive folks you'll find. Their monthly story swaps are held on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Printing Museum at 1324 West Clay. There's plenty of parking and plenty of fun. Check out their site for all the fun happenings at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Also, be sure to visit us on the So What's Your Story Facebook page for information about our guests, storytelling events, and a whole lot more. And please, like us on the way out.
What a great job. All right, you must have one hell of a brilliant speech teacher. That's all I can tell you, because that is the most articulate thing I've ever heard. Jake, take a walk. Okay, thank you so much. Hey, listen, more exciting stuff. Extraordinary teller Mary Edgerton, and she's been a guest on the show, very good friend of Warren Holloman. Dr. Edgerton will be joining Warren, Greg, and myself as a member of our hosting team in August, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about her in upcoming weeks. Welcome, Mary. Nicole, how you interviewed someone and learned something new about Anthony's case is the focus of your next story, right?
Right.
Looking forward to it.
So I said that one of the things we were looking for was information that the jury hadn't heard, and that Anthony was convicted based in part on the testimony of a jail guard who said he heard Anthony say something incriminating over the jail intercom system. This testimony was problematic for a number of reasons. For one, we learned that the jail intercom was very unreliable. It rarely worked. For another, this jail guard had never met Anthony or heard Anthony's voice. Now, when you're listening to an intercom in another room, you can't see who is speaking. How was the guard able to recognize Anthony's voice if he had never heard Anthony speak? The guard testified that another guard, I'll call him guard number two, was also present and heard the incriminating statements. And guard number two had met Anthony, had heard his voice, and had identified the intercom speaker as Anthony. But guard number two never testified at Anthony's trial. I wondered why not. Why had the district attorney called guard number one, but not guard number two as a witness. Guard number two's testimony would have been stronger. He would have been a better witness. It took me years to find guard number two, even though I thought I had his name. It turned out that he went by his middle name, and to find him, I had to learn his real first name. Then he had an unlisted phone number, and the only address I could find was a post office box. But ultimately, after years of searching, I made friends with one of his friends who agreed to arrange a meeting. So guard number two agreed to meet me at a fast food restaurant outside of Caldwell, Texas. I was incredibly nervous on my 2.5-hour drive to the restaurant. Would guard number two tell me what I thought was the truth? That the incriminating statement was fabricated. It had never happened. Or would he confirm guard number one's testimony and say that he heard Anthony's voice through the intercom? If so, my investigation would end up hurting my client's case. And it didn't help my nervousness when a few minutes after I arrived at the restaurant, four law enforcement officers walked in and sat down nearby. I didn't think that was coincidental. I often suspected I was being followed as I drove around interviewing potential witnesses. Guard number two arrived. He approached me. He sat down at my table. He was a big man, very Texan, kind of quiet. He confirmed he had been a jailhouse guard in 1992 and that he remembered Anthony Graves and Robert Carter being in the jail. I asked him, "Did you overhear Anthony making incriminating statements over the jailhouse intercom?" He said no. He said the only thing he ever heard Anthony say was that he was innocent and had been wrongly accused. Well, I said, "Well, did you identify Anthony's voice to guard number one?" He said, "No, that never happened. It never happened." Guard number two wrote out a statement for me at that fast food restaurant, and we went to a local bank where he signed it in front of a notary. The last thing I asked him was why he had never come forward with this information back in 1992. He told me no one had ever asked him to. Yet again, we learned that Anthony's conviction had been based on lies.
I know you've told these stories before many times, but I want you to know how much I appreciate you telling them again, because those who haven't heard them need to, and those who have need to hear them again.
You know, I don't think I've ever told that story before.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think that's one that I've never shared.
It unfolded so comfortably that it seemed like you did, but we need to hear these stories. You know, I teach a principles of interviewing course, and I cover everything from information gathering to health interviews. And information gathering is a challenging one because anything less than the truth is unacceptable, I tell my students. And I'm curious, how do you teach your students to write the whole truth in your news writing course? I know you teach that class as well.
So one of the things that I say a lot, I tell my students that good journalism has been described as a discipline of verification. It's a discipline of verification. So information isn't accurate just because someone said it, or because you saw it on social media, or because you found it in a Google search. My students, they'll tell you that I say over and over again that, you know, the internet is not a source. It's just not.
Oh, God bless you for saying that. My God.
Information has to be verified, and verification takes hard work. There aren't any shortcuts.
Right.
And you get information by talking to people.
Right.
Not through looking something up on Google.
Right. I thank you so much for saying that, because just today in class I was talking about the fact that the internet is not a source. A website is not a source.
Right.
You know, www, I read, it's an address. That's
right.
It. Talking to people, viewing that's, internally, that's what the word means.
And a story isn't just something that's reheated.
No.
That you found on the internet. I mean, it's got to be fresh. It has to be new information that you yourself learned.
Right.
Not just paraphrased from an internet source.
Right. Exactly. And you have to access it very carefully. I love the fact that you invest in your students, because all too often they really get a bad rap. And you treat them so well and you're so wonderful to them. And I respect you so much as an educator as well as the consummate attorney. But we never, ever, ever forget these youngins on So What's Your Story? Not on this watch. We're going to continue to prove it next week with a mild shift in tone when my guest will be Jeremy Jason, a young man with a penchant for Greek myths. Right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are absorbed by my guest teller, attorney, and St. Thomas professor, Nicole Kozarov. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up? Just a real quick shift in gears. Because I know you like storytelling. You told me a little bit earlier that you know Susan Gallagher.
Right, yeah.
She's been on the show. Magnificent Irish teller.
You know, I guess
she
I
drinks because, you know, she's Irish.
I guess I would say my dad, but also, you know, I had a favorite aunt, and she was a good storyteller and always made sure I had plenty of books, too.
What kind of books?
You name it.
What was your favorite? What do you like to read? You have to be an avid reader, right?
I read constantly.
Yeah.
You know, I read a lot of nonfiction. I like Supreme Court biographies. Mm-hmm. My husband does, too. Mm-hmm. But fiction, too. You know, anything from mysteries to literature classics.
Yeah, the whole works.
You know?
You really can't be a good writer unless you read, because you don't know what sentences look like.
That's exactly right.
Does that make any sense?
I tell my students that constantly.
Thank God I'm talking to someone who understands me, because the rest of the world does not.
And I tell them that they need to read good writing, that's what they need to emulate.
Right.
So they need to read it, and if they don't read it, they'll never figure out how to do it.
Exactly, yeah. I know people who write, and I tell them this isn't really good writing, and they'll say, well, I'll just rewrite it, and I'll just proofread it and write it again. And I tell them, well, unless you read and know what good reading and good writing looks like, all you're doing is recycling bad writing. You're finding creative ways to write poorly, right? This theme tonight, Anthony Graves, in a sentence, what do you want us to take away from tonight?
That just because someone is accused of a crime doesn't mean that they are guilty of a crime, and that if you get called for jury duty, you shouldn't try to get out of it, because we need smart people who have open minds to go serve on juries.
They're all pointing at me. I am definitely going, okay, so everybody leave me alone. They're all picking on me because I went to that 1-800 number trying to get out of it. This has been an outstanding night of narratives, placing the spotlight squarely on the shoulders of human dignity and fairness for all to see. Thank you so much, Nicole Kozarov, for spotlighting the essence of a fair society, that exercising fairness isn't a spectator sport. Everyone has to play to make it work. The stories that you told tonight teach us what the Little Book of Inspirations author H. Jackson Brown Jr. has touted. Live so that when your children think of fairness, caring, and integrity, they think of you. And it's certainly how we feel right here on So What's Your Story. That's how we think of you, Nicole. And I hope that we can get you back here, because there are some things that I'd love to be able to talk with you about. Will you do that?
Sure.
Was it this painful for you?
Oh, no. It was a pleasure.
Can you stay up this late? Because I'm having a hard time. Yeah. Those of us a little over 21 it's 10 o'clock. Give me a break. Remember to send your comments about any of our shows or suggestions about guests and program themes to drhank@kpft.org, and Greg Warren or I will get back to you real soon. Scooter is up next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, I want you to join us every Thursday at 10 for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. And don't ever forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
June, KPFT was seeking listeners like you to run for our board of directors, and you responded. In the coming weeks, you'll be hearing statements by candidates seeking your vote, candidate forums in which candidates will speak to you, and more efforts to educate you about the 2016 board elections. Please note that candidate statements may not represent the views of KPFT. You're encouraged to research candidate statements, ask the general manager, and cast an informed vote in the interest of a diverse and multi-talented board of directors. Listener members are eligible to vote for our board. You can donate today to of a diverse and multi-talented board of directors. Listener members are eligible to vote for our board. You can donate today to